When you think back on the important events in your life, how much can you truly remember? A few words here, a fleeting emotion there, a glimpse of something beautiful? How many gaps are filled by imagination, by wishful thinking, even self-deception? Memories, for all their value, are as intangible as shadows. In time, even the most solid memories fracture, like the glass of a broken mirror. The throne room. An apparition manifested in the open doorway. The ghostly figure was slim and clad in a flowing gown. Her face was that of an elven maiden, composed with sharp angles that would have been unattractive on a human. On elves, though, the features hinted at a sort of geometric perfection. Gesmus felt the weight on his heart that had nothing to do with his injuries. One of the dead riders laid skeletal hands on Gesmus and shoved him through the apparition. The banshee howled her impotent rage at the violation. The sound shook the spy as he passed through. Her chill form clutched at him, trying to seize his living warmth even as it shrank from his coarse physicality. He emerged, breathless and shivering, in an immense entry hall. Twin stairways climbed the walls of the vast circular room, leading to a balcony opposite the main doors. The balcony might once have been a musician's gallery. Now the only music in the hall came from the banshee's keening song. The unquiet spirits hovered in midair or wove frenzied patterns through the chandelier suspended from the ceiling center. All the candles in those triple rings of iron were lit. Their radiance diluted the gloom that choked the hall, but could not vanquish it. Upon a dais shrouded in the hall's deepest shadows sat a worm-eaten throne, and upon that throne hunched a suit of armor. The plate mail appeared empty, deserted. The once bright metal was blackened with soot and age. Tatters fringed the purple cloak draped over the armor's shoulders. The tasseled helmet drooped forward. Only the faint lights flickering in the helmet's eye slits betrayed the fact that something lurked within that fire-blasted metal skin. The banshees ceased their keening and turned to the dais. Their faces grew even more horrible with anticipation. The skeletal warrior, Sos Lord Retainer of old, seemed to share their anxiety. Gesmus felt its bony fingers tighten on his shoulders. Finally, Soth stirred upon his dilapidated throne. The twin flickers of orange light that were his eyes flared, or perhaps the hall grew suddenly darker. All heat, all hope, drained from the room. It was as if those things flowed into Soth, fuel for his terrible gaze. Hello, and welcome to D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and today we will be discussing Spectre of the Black Rose by James Lowder and Veronica Whitney Robinson, published in 1999 by TSR. Before we get started, however, I have a few exciting announcements. First, I have been asked to become a co-host of the Dragonlance Canticle podcast, created by the Dragonlance Nexus. It's a fantastic podcast about all things Dragonlance, and you can hear it by visiting dragonlancenexus.com/podcast. Also available on Dragonlance Nexus is a free PDF called Tasselhoff's Pouches of Everything, an unofficial 5th edition campaign setting for Dragonlance. This book features everything you need to run a fully realized campaign on Kryn using 5th edition rules, as well as gorgeous artwork. The book is 100% free, so there's no reason to not get it. Next, if you want to hear more of me and more about Lord Soth, listen to my appearance on the Slovenly Trolls podcast, where we discuss Lord Soth's toxic relationships and compare him to some of our world's worst monsters. Finally, for all you horror movie fans out there, I recently made a guest appearance on the Nothing to Fear podcast, where host Billy and I discussed my favorite movie, Halloween, and the franchise it spawned. You can find the Slovenly Trolls podcast and Nothing to Fear anywhere you listen to podcasts. As always, please be sure to follow me at D&D Book Club on Instagram. That's D-A-N-D-D Book Club. and now on Twitter at Miss Megan J. That's MEAGHAN. If you want access to exclusive bonus episodes, you can become a patron for just $5 a month by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. There will, of course, be links in the show notes. Okay, enough announcements. Let's talk Soth. Spectre of the Black Rose is the second part of a two-part series of Ravenloft novels, featuring the Death Knight's escapades in the Land of the Mists. The duology is collectively known as the Terror of Lord Soth. Personally, I think of Knight of the Black Rose and Spectre of the Black Rose as part of an unofficial trilogy, along with Ado Van Belcombe's Dragonlance series novel, simply titled Lord Soth, covered previously on this podcast. The novels all inform and draw upon one another, so I think they're best read together, even if there is an inconsistent continuity. I've read rumors that there was a third Ravenloft novel featuring Soth planned, but I haven't been able to find confirmation. Spectre of the Black Rose had its own drama happening behind the scenes. It was published in 1999, and it was the last book published in the original series, 2 years after TSR was bought out by Wizards of the Coast, but before the Wizards of the Coast name began appearing on D&D products. So obviously, it was a transition period for the company and the brand. You may have also noticed in my introduction that Spectre has two authors, James Lowder, the author of the original, and Veronica Whitney Robinson. According to an interview given by James Lowder, available on fraternityofshadows.com, he could not complete the novel alone because of an illness in the family, and Veronica Whitney Robinson was brought in to complete it. According to Lowder, however, the two did work closely together on the project. There is, of course, another wrinkle in the behind-the-scenes drama. Apparently, during the time that Knight of the Black Rose was written, Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, the creators of Lord Soth and Dragonlance, were invited to participate, but declined due to issues they were having with the company. Again, this is taken from that same interview with James Lowder. I was not able to find any comments by Weiss and Hickman on the topic. James Lowder was tapped to write the novel instead, and ultimately became the godfather of Soth in Ravenloft. I also found a quote from Tracy Hickman, himself the creator of the Ravenloft concept along with his wife Laura, indicating that he did not like the idea of characters being able to travel to Barovia from other worlds, which is, of course, the central conceit of the second edition Ravenloft campaign setting. I do not have a citation for that quote, so take it with a grain of salt. What this all boils down to is that there exists a disconnect regarding whether Soth was ever truly in Ravenloft. If you look at it from the Ravenloft angle, yes, he was. If you look at it from the Dragonlance angle, no, he wasn't. He's kind of like Schrodinger's Death Knight in that way. But since Jeremy Crawford at Wizards of the Coast recently announced that all pre-5th edition materials are no longer official canon, I suppose the point is ultimately moot. Personally, I'm just glad that we have so many Lord Soth stories to enjoy, although I wish it could have been accomplished in a way that satisfied all the parties involved. There is one final addendum to this story, although I'm going to save it for later in the episode. With that being said, this episode will contain spoilers for Spectre of the Black Rose, as well as Knight of the Black Rose, as well as a minor spoiler for the Dragonlance novel, Dragons of a Vanished Moon. So you may want to stop listening now if you prefer to read those novels first. Before we dive into the story proper, let's do a quick recap of the previous novel. Back on his home world of Kryn, Lord Soth had made an alliance with the dragon High Lord Kitiara Uthmatar to conquer the wealthy and strategically important city of Palanthas. They were defeated, but Soth succeeded in his true objective, to orchestrate Kitiara's death so he could claim her body and transform her into his undead wife. Upon returning to his home at Dargard Keep, he was betrayed by a seneschal, the ghost Caradoc, who had been tasked with retrieving Kitiara's soul from the abyss. At that moment, Soth and Caradoc were both taken by the mists into the land of Barovia. In Barovia, Soth quickly made a few allies and a few enemies. He murdered a Vistani matriarch and kidnapped her granddaughter Magda, but not before the elder Vistani cursed him never to find his way home again. Soth journeyed to Castle Ravenloft, where he learned of a possible escape route back to Kryn from the vampire lord, Count Strahd. But Strahd did not want such a powerful being traipsing around unchecked through his land, so he sought to imprison him in the castle. Soth and Magda managed to escape, however, and met up with a dwarven werebadger and serial killer named Azrael. Unfortunately, Strahd's supposed portal turned out to be a dead end. Strahd then made an arrangement with Soth. Soth and his companions would travel to the neighboring domain of Gundarak and kill the Duke of Gundarak's creepy magic-using son, Madreau, who was essentially an immortal child. In doing so, Soth could use the power in Madreau's blood to open a portal back to Kryn. Soth succeeded in killing the Duke's son, but the portal only transported him back to Barovia. In a rage, Soth launched a one-man war against Strahd, who quickly realized he had to redirect Soth's aggression. Strahd released the ghost Caradoc, who had hitherto been under the vampire's protection. Terrified of Soth's wrath, Caradoc fled to the misty border of Barovia, with Soth pursuing him. As Strahd had intended, Soth pursued Caradoc into the mists themselves. The dark powers who ruled the demiplane of dread offered Soth the chance to change the past, to rewrite his own history, and to undo the mistakes that had led to his damnation. Soth, ever the Edgelord, rebuffed their offer and let his wife and child die all over again, as they had done hundreds of years before. As a reward and a punishment for this act of supreme evil, Soth was granted his very own domain of dread, Sithicus, the land of specters. The novel begins with a man named Gesmus Maliterno, a spy sent to Sithicus by Malocchio Adair, lord of the neighboring domain of Invidia. Quick side note, although Adair is the political ruler of Invidia, he is not the capital D Dark Lord, and thus is not a prisoner in his land. Gesmus was born with a deformed leg and walks with a brace, but his cleverness and his preternatural flashes of insight make him a talented spy. Despite this innate aptitude for espionage, Gesmus isn't happy in his line of work. What he really wants to do is take care of animals, horses, hounds, etc. Simple work for simple folk. That's his dream. Gesmus's mission to Sithicus is to gather as much information about the history of Lord Soth as possible. Apparently, the lords of the neighboring domains haven't read Lord Soth, so he is quite an enigma. Adair is planning on making war against Sithicus soon and believes any insight into Soth's afterlife story could be potentially useful. While on the road, Gesmus is set upon by Azrael, now Soth's second in command, along with some of Soth's skeletal warriors. Gesmus calls out to the Lord of Invidia, and Malocchio Adair appears. Before Gesmus can give his master the notes he has collected, a strange song fills the air, a song of confessed crimes. Gesmus feels himself compelled to join into the song, adding his own sins to the chorus. The guilt-stricken lamentation is Soth's doing, his way of sealing the borders to his land. Lord Adair is forced to depart, and Gesmus is captured. Azrael decides to bring the spy to see Soth personally at Soth's castle, Nerdregard Keep. During the journey, we learn from Azrael that Soth has been neglecting his responsibilities as ruler and that the country has been suffering as a result of his negligence. A disease known as the White Fever is running rampant through the land, and the so-called feral elves of the Iron Hills are wreaking havoc under the direction of a mysterious leader called the White Rose. This suits Azrael just fine. He thrives on chaos and suffering. We learn from Gesmus about two strange figures which supposedly haunt the domain, known only as the Bloody Cobbler and the Whispering Beast. An obviously frightened Azrael dismisses them as fairy tales. Azrael and Gesmus arrive at Soth's keep. In the throne room, Soth has been sitting motionless on his throne for years, his mind lost in the past. On the wall behind him, there are mirrors which Soth previously used to travel into his own memories. These don't play into the story, but I'm pointing them out because they are a central plot device in the second edition Ravenloft module, When Black Roses Bloom, set in Sithicus. As always, Soth is accompanied by wailing banshees who spend their eternities taunting Soth and singing of his damnation. Strangely, there aren't 13 banshees like there were on Kryn. The number seems to be constantly changing. It's a unique feature of Soth's punishment that his castle is like a distorted memory of his castle on Kryn. Like a memory, it is inconstant. Soth addresses Gesmus and orders him to tell the Death Knight his own story. Gesmus does so, using the scraps he has collected. Most of it Soth dismisses as folk tales or flights of fancy, but there are elements of truth in it. Soth deduces that Gesmus must have heard some of his tale from the Wanderers, a group of Istani led by Soth's former captive, Magda, the only person who knows the truth of how Soth came to the Land of the Mists. After this exchange, Soth decides to send Gesmus to work in the salt mines. Gesmus has provided Soth with some diversion, and that is enough to earn the spy his life. Soth decides the time has come for him to take a more active role in the ruling of his land, and his first act is to oversee the release of some of the prisoners in his dungeon, so they too can join Gesmus in the mines. Gesmus and the prisoners are loaded into a wagon to be transported to their new home. Along the way, however, the wagon is ambushed by the feral elves of the Iron Hills. The wagon crashes and Gesmus plays dead. When he feels safe enough to survey what happened, he finds that some of the prisoners have been freed by the elves and some have been killed and their bodies burned. Gesmus assumes that he is alone, but that assumption, like so many others, is wrong. A man wearing an ash-gray cloak, a wide-brimmed hat, and a plague mask appears. He seems friendly enough until he opens his small leather case of cobbler's tools. At that moment, Gesmus realizes who this man truly is, the bloody cobbler himself. When a group of hunters stumble upon the scene, they find Gesmus lying in the road, his face oddly serene, barefoot, with the soles of his feet carefully removed. Our story then shifts to the small town outside the Vidrava salt mines. Inside a two-story building which serves as a shop and a warehouse, the shop's proprietor, a middle-aged man named Ambrose, cares for a young woman named Helene, who is afflicted with madness. She is attended upon with utmost devotion by her fiancé, a young man named Ganelon. Ganelon was once an adventurer until he met Helene. The two fell in love, and he decided to settle down with her. Days before their wedding, however, Helene was struck with an inexplicable insanity, from which she has been suffering for the past year. She wakes from a nightmare, ranting and raving about a spy, but Ganelon and Ambrose dismiss it as nonsense. Downstairs in the shop, Magda arrives with her daughter Inza and a Vistani man named Bratu in order to deliver some goods to Ambrose to trade for salt. Ambrose, like most of the racist people in Ravenloft, does not trust Vistani and rebuffs Magda's offer of a charm to help Helene. As the two are conducting their business, Azrael and Lord Soth appear from the shadows. Azrael and Magda despise one another, but Soth's presence keeps them under control. Soth has sought out Magda in order to ensure that she has not been spreading his secrets. The two have an alliance, and one of the conditions of that alliance is that none of Magda's wanderers may speak of Soth's true history. Magda tells Soth that their bargain remains intact and informs the Death Knight that the so-called Thorns of the White Rose, the elven rebels to Soth's rule, seem to know even more about his history on Kryn than she does. Soth is satisfied that Magda is keeping his secrets, but urges her to make sure her people are doing the same. He then instructs Magda that she will accompany him to a meeting with Malokio Adair in 3 days' time. Meanwhile, Soth will send Azrael to search for the identity of the White Rose. During this exchange, we learn something interesting about Soth. Apparently, his memories have become inconstant, just like Ner'Dragard itself. Not all of his memories can be trusted. After Soth and Azrael depart, Magda confronts her man Bratu. She suspects that Bratu, who has mysteriously come into some money recently, has been selling Soth's secrets. He has broken the oath he made to Magda, and thus Magda publicly proclaims him an oathbreaker. In Sithicus, however, being called an oathbreaker is more than damaging to one's reputation. Those who break their oaths become the prey of the Whispering Beast. Once Magda leaves, Bratu begs Inza to intercede with her mother and ask her mother to remove the curse. He even threatens to reveal the truth, that Inza has been selling Soth's secrets as well. In reply, Inza gives Bratu a knitting needle, for when the beast's whispering becomes too much to bear. A few days later, Azrael returns to the town of Vidrava on a mysterious errand. He gives Ambrose the shopkeeper an ornate box intended for Inza with instructions that it is not to be opened under any circumstances. This done, Azrael walks to the entrance to the mine, to a building called the Engine House. Inside the Engine House is an imprisoned giant named Nabon, whose legs have been repeatedly broken by Azrael. The giant is responsible for raising and lowering the lifts going in and out of the mine. Currently, one of the lifts is stuck, and Azrael orders Nabon to drop it, killing the passengers. Azrael travels into the mine in his own private lift to a place called the Black Chapel, an abandoned holy place formerly used by the miners, where he has a strange conversation with the shadows themselves. After this, Azrael inspects his treasure hoard, which he has been amassing with one ultimate goal in mind, to overthrow Lord Zoth and replace him as the Lord of Sithicus. Azrael proceeds deeper underground to a hidden subterranean lake called the Lake of Sounds. By drinking its water, Azrael can hear every word spoken in Sithicus and has, in essence, become a one-man intelligence agency. This is also where Azrael goes to speak to a being or a group of beings he simply refers to as the Dark, an evil entity of immense power which has promised him dominion over all of Sithicus and even provided him with the means to achieve it. Azrael is eavesdropping as Zoth and Magda arrive on the bridge connecting the domains of Sithicus and Invidia. Malocchio Adair appears, escorted by ogres and human soldiers. He demands that Zoth turn over all the Vistani in his domain to him. You see, if Ambrose the shopkeeper is your average everyday racist, Adair is a full-on proud boy. His goal is to kill every Vistani in Ravenloft, and he has a particular grudge against Magda. Zoth and Adair bandy words back and forth. Zoth demands Adair stop sending spies into Sithicus and cease any dealings with the White Rose. During the course of their conversation, Adair lets slip that the White Rose is a woman. Zoth knows immediately that the White Rose must be Kitiara, the peerless general he murdered. Moments later, all hell breaks loose, if hell can be said to break loose in a hellish world like Ravenloft. Adair launches an attack against Zoth and Magda. Zoth easily dispatches humans and ogres alike, and Magda, armed with her magical cudgel, manages to stand her ground. The Invidians don't really have a chance, of course. Zoth summons his banshees and his skeletal warriors to join in the fight, and they begin slaughtering Adair's troops. With no other choice, the Invidians are forced to retreat. Now, before I continue with the story, I want to give myself a quick plug. I have been publishing original material on the DMs Guild. The first publication is a collection of 6 pre-generated characters created specifically for Ravenloft games, with Ravenloft-specific themes and backstories, available in both PDF and Fantasy Grounds formats. There's a half-vampire halfling, a warlock on a secret mission from the Lich of Zalin Rex, a bard who talks to ghosts, and more. The collection is free, so please download it and leave a comment if you enjoyed it. The link can be found in the show notes. Now, back to where we left off. Magda returns to her camp and finds that Bratu, the man she cursed, has had his tongue torn out by her daughter Inza. Since Magda named him an oathbreaker, he has used the knitting needle Inza gave him to mutilate his own ears in the hope that he would no longer be able to hear the whispering beast, to little avail. To spare herself having to listen to his insane ravings, Inza ordered his tongue to be removed. Magda is furious, declaring that Bratu is one of them, even if he is an oathbreaker, and should have been treated with compassion. Suddenly, the camp is attacked by beings called Salt Shadows, undead creatures of pure darkness born from the Vedrava mine. The shadows possess living people and take over their bodies. In this instance, one possesses the body of Magda's hound, Sabek, and attacks Inza. Magda rushes to her daughter's defense, but her magical, supposedly unbreakable cudgel is destroyed, and Magda is mortally wounded. She calls out to Zoth for aid, and the Death Knight appears, dispatching the remaining shadows. With her last breath, Magda releases Zoth from the curse her grandmother laid upon him, and asks him to protect her daughter, to which he agrees. As Magda dies, a strange occurrence takes place. Solinari, the silver moon of Kryn, suddenly appears in the sky. Once Magda is dead, Zoth inspects her wagon and finds a chest which was used to sneak the Salt Shadows into the camp. Inza says she thinks the chest came from Malocchio Adair, but Zoth knows it must have been Azrael. Zoth travels to the Lake of Sounds to confront Azrael. He admits to sending the Salt Shadows against Magda, but insists he did it to protect Zoth, claiming that Magda made an alliance with the White Rose. Zoth doesn't trust Azrael, but he needs him for the time being, so he orders Azrael to make war against the elven rebels. Zoth then drinks from the waters of the Lake of Sounds and hears the voices of the people of Sithicus in his mind. As he listens, he hears echoes of his own history being told, and the gaps in his memory begin to fill. Of course, Azrael neglects to tell Zoth about the conversations he has been having with his imaginary friend, the Dark itself. Back at Ambrose's shop, Ganelon isn't doing well. He's injured his leg somehow, and he's having trouble walking normally. 2 men enter the shop, 2 members of Azrael's secret police. They interrogate the townspeople, pushing them around and acting like big jerks, until Ambrose attacks them in a very uncharacteristic display of violence, killing one of them. The violence and the excitement is too much for Helene, who throws herself out of a window and flees into the night. As Ganelon pursues her, Ambrose brutally murders the other police agent. Ganelon follows Helaine through the Scythican night, but loses track of her when she disappears down a hole. He descends into the hole and finds a tunnel. Crawling through it, he is pursued by its tentacled bat-like denizens, but manages to escape out the other side, although there is no sign of Helaine. Instead, he meets a familiar figure, a man dressed in a plague mask and a wide-brimmed hat. The bloody cobbler tells Ganelon not to worry, that Helaine is safe, and even gives him a leg brace he can wear to help him walk on his lame leg. However, he doesn't mention that he took the brace from the spy Gesmus after he murdered him. At last, we get some insight into what the cobbler is all about. He seeks out people who have ignored their purpose in life, kills them, and removes the soles of their feet. Then he stitches those souls onto a deserving person who just needs a little help finding their true calling. In this case, he has stitched the souls of the spy Gesmus onto Ganelon to help him find his feet, so to speak, as an adventurer and a hero. Ganelon's new limp is a result of that process. As the two are speaking of Lord Soth, Soth himself is able to overhear their conversation from the Lake of Sounds. He uses his magic to travel through the shadows to the place where Ganelon and the cobbler have met. Ganelon prostrates himself, but the cobbler speaks to Soth with a familiar, even mocking tone. Soth allows Ganelon to leave, to continue his search for Helaine, but the cobbler makes Ganelon swear upon his love for her that he will not tell anyone about this encounter. Once Ganelon has done so, the bloody cobbler gives him a clue to help him find Helaine, and then the young man departs, leaving Soth and the cobbler alone. Soth speaks to the cobbler of Kitiara, but the cobbler only replies with cryptic comments only one familiar with Soth's true history would know, then vanishes into thin air. As Ganelon continues to pursue Helaine, he is captured by Inza and her tribe. He admits that he is pursuing Helaine with help from the cobbler, but will not tell her any more of his encounter with the cobbler than that. First, Inza tortures him, cutting off his earlobe, but Ganelon doesn't give in. Next, she uses magic, inducing a dream in which Helaine is restored to health, and asks Ganelon to tell her what transpired between him and the cobbler. Again, he refuses. At last, Inza releases a salt shadow from a small box to possess Ganelon, but the strange magic worked upon him by the cobbler protects him from the salt shadows. At that moment, a cacophonous sound erupts from the forest, scattering the Vistani. The whispering beast himself has come to Ganelon's aid. When Ganelon comes to, he finds Helaine safe with the whispering beast. This isn't much comfort to Ganelon, however, since the beast is a man so badly deformed and diseased and covered in filth and hair that he's barely recognizable as a man. And he's kind of a pervert, too. He is surrounded by lunatics, the victims of his whispering, all people who broke a vow and were cursed to hear his whispers in their minds until they went insane. The beast explains that Helaine herself is a victim of his curse, for swearing to love Ganelon forever, only to fall out of love when the dashing young roustabout she met turned into a safe and dependable homebody. It was Ganelon's denial of his true calling that earned him the attention of the bloody cobbler. Of course, Ganelon is enraged by this, but before he can do anything about it, the White Rose appears. The White Rose is a woman covered head to toe in white cloth. She explains to Ganelon that, since he has proven himself trustworthy by resisting Inza's interrogations, she is going to give him an important mission. He is going to help collect red roses from across the border in Invidia. Red roses are needed to complete a ritual to bring Lunatari, Kryn's red moon, to Scythicus. The White Rose has already brought Solinari to Scythicus, and bringing Lunatari is the last step in her plan to defeat Soth. Unfortunately, only black roses bloom in Scythicus, which is why they need to travel to other domains to find the properly hued flowers. In exchange for Ganelon's help, the White Rose will cure Helaine of her madness. Ganelon agrees for Helaine's sake. Back at Inza's camp, we learn that the Vistani girl is more than she appears. She possesses a magical dagger called Novgor, a dagger once owned by the Vistani hero Kolchak the Wanderer, the same Kolchak who also possessed Magda's magical cudgel once upon a time. Inza used the dagger to score the wood of Magda's cudgel so it would fail her against the salt shadows. Inza betrayed her mother to her death so that she could become the leader of the tribe. As Inza is pondering these things, a band of ogres attacks the camp, killing most of the Vistani before Soth can respond to Inza's call for help. After Soth dispatches the ogres, he finds gold in their pouches and deduces that these ogres, while originally the soldiers of Malocchio Adair, have been bought off by Azrael, and this has all been a diversion to get Soth out of Nerdregard Keep. Soth then tells Inza to order her remaining Vistani to travel to the keep, and he even reanimates the dead ogres to serve as guardians. As for Inza herself, he whisks her away to the keep with his magic, thinking to protect her as he promised her mother he would do. The Vistani embark on their journey after burying their dead, bringing Inza's strongbox along with them. She was very insistent on that point. Once Soth and the Vistani are gone, the bloody cobbler appears. Using his own magic, he reanimates the corpses of the dead Vistani. Ganelon and a posse of insane florists he's been lent by the Whispering Beast travel to Invidia in search of red roses. They find some in a spot creepily named Malocchio's Dream Garden, where the racist lord of Invidia has planted rose bushes in the corpses of dead Vistani. The nature of these rose bushes makes them extremely dangerous, since disturbing the vines on which the roses grow can cause the bushes to attack and drink the blood their thorns draw from their victims. Of course, the bushes are disturbed, and a few of the beast's victims are killed by the roses, but the mission is accomplished. Before Ganelon can leave, however, Malocchio Adair himself appears. He is about to kill Ganelon when Ganelon explains that he is also an enemy of Soth, and the enemy of my enemy, etc., etc. Adair explains that he had made an alliance with Azrael to overthrow Soth, but Azrael has betrayed him and co-opted his troops with generous bribes. In truth, Azrael is planning some unholy rite to steal the shadows of every person in Sithicus, and use those shadows as his own personal army of terror. That's the plan which the Dark has given to Azrael through the Lake of Sounds. In punishment for Azrael's treachery, Lord Adair gives Ganelon a special poison he can use against the Werebadger, since normal weapons cannot harm him. Ganelon takes the poison and leaves the Rose Garden. Back at Vedrava Mine, the imprisoned giant named Nabon wakes up to discover that his formerly ruined legs appear to have been restored to pristine working order. He soon finds that this miracle was actually the work of the bloody cobbler, who stole the souls of the dead Vistani to restore Nabon's legs, that he might find his purpose in life again. The giant bursts out of the engine house and flees the mines. Azrael shows up a moment too late and confronts the cobbler. The two chat for a few moments, and we learn that it was not Azrael who sent the ogres to destroy the Vistani. It was Inza herself. It was all part of a scheme to get herself into Nerdregard Keep. Inza has been waiting with Soth for the rest of her tribe to arrive, and finally they reach the keep with the Invidian army hot on their heels. Inza's primary concern is, of course, her strongbox. Soth climbs to the battlements of the keep, where he notices the words, "My honor is my life," carved into the stone. Soth is taken aback. He carved these words himself into the stone when he was a boy, but that was Dargard Keep, not Nerdregard. Somehow, his castle in Sithicus is coming to resemble his castle on Kryn more and more. As he looks down from above, he sees the arrival of the Invidian army. Then he sees the arrival of his own elven army from the east and his human army from the south. Instead of attacking the Invidians, however, the Sithicans join them, and a newly formed allied army lays siege to Nerdregard Keep. This has all been a part of Azrael's plan. Soth confers with Inza, who gives him a dubious reading from her Taroka deck, Ravenloft's unique version of a tarot deck. The reading, along with a few subtle hints from Inza, convinces Soth that he needs to go to Vedrava Mine to confront Azrael before Azrael can perform the rite he intends to steal the shadows from Sithicus. Soth leaves to confront Azrael and, once he's gone, Inza removes a bottle of black ooze from her strongbox. This ooze has the power to ward the keep against Soth and his minions. Soth's skeletal warriors and his banshees are driven out, and Inza invites the besieging armies inside. At Vedrava Mine, Soth is prevented from entering. Azrael has used the same black ooze that Inza used to keep Soth out of the mine. The banshees appear and tell Soth that Inza has betrayed him. Of course, if you know anything at all about Lord Soth, you know it doesn't matter if the world is about to be devastated by a cataclysm, or his kingdom is about to be overthrown by a shadow-stealing werebadger. The one thing in this world, that world, or any world that Soth cannot abide is being tricked by a woman. With Soth gone, Ganelon enters the mine as the red moon Lunatari begins to appear in the afternoon sky. Ganelon is not repelled by the same force which repelled Soth, because the magic that keeps out the dead doesn't bar the living. Ganelon makes his way to the Black Chapel where Azrael is conducting his rite. He pours the poison into a chalice upon the altar there. A moment later, he is attacked by his friends from town, including Ambrose the shopkeeper. All three have been possessed by salt shadows and now serve Azrael. Azrael arrives and Ganelon watches helpless as he conducts his ritual, pulling all the shadows from Sithicus to him, all except Inza's, although Azrael doesn't realize this. At the end of the rite, Azrael drinks from the chalice. As the poison begins to take effect, Azrael realizes something has gone horribly wrong, and he hears the voice of the dark speaking to him, as it had been speaking to him from the Lake of Sounds. Only the voice is that of Inza. It was her all along, feeding him lies, telling him what he wanted to hear, using him as her pawn in her grand scheme. The poison doesn't kill Azrael, but Ganelon is able to make his escape, releasing his former friends from the possession of the salt shadows in the process. Back on the surface, Ganelon sees all the shadows summoned by Azrael rising into the sky to form a shadowy mountain. The shadowy mountain falls to the earth and shatters, devastating the land. At Ner'drogard Keep, the wards Inza has put in place to keep Soth out fail. Her magic is simply no match for his misogynistic rage. Soth, his warriors, and his banshees destroy the besieging army. A fire begins to spread within the castle. Soth confronts Inza, but before Soth can kill her, the White Rose appears, along with the bloody cobbler and the whispering beast. The White Rose speaks to Soth, and he recognizes her voice. She isn't Kitiara after all. She is Isolde, Soth's elven wife, the woman who burned to death in the fire which ended Soth's own life, the same woman who cursed Soth to an eternity of undeath. Isolde tells Inza to depart. Outside the keep, Inza encounters the giant Naban. Naban has been looking for her. It was Inza who first met Naban, befriended him, then betrayed and crippled him. She gave him to Azrael in exchange for her dagger, Novgor. Knowing the giant has come to kill her, Inza chooses instead to throw herself into the great chasm surrounding Ner'drogard Keep, robbing all those she has harmed of any measure of justice. But as she falls deep into the chasm, something catches her. As Soth and Isolde speak, she reveals the true identities of the Whispering Beast and the Bloody Cobbler. The Whispering Beast is Soth's first son, sired upon his human wife, Lady Gladria. The Bloody Cobbler is his second, the half-elven son of Soth and Isolde. They are reflections of Soth's own failings as a man and as a knight. The Whispering Beast punishes those who broke their oaths. The Cobbler punishes those who fail in their life's calling. Isolde explains that the power of the curse she once laid upon him has drawn her to Sithicus to restore the memories he has been losing during his time in the Land of Spectres, to make sure that Soth never forgets what he has done and can never shrug off the weight of his crimes. Soth has a vision of the night his second wife and son died, the night of the Cataclysm. He is offered a chance to save them once again, but, once again, turns his back. In doing so, all his fragmentary memories are returned. In the time after the destruction of Ner'drogard Keep, the voice of Inza can be heard speaking from the chasm into which she fell, but her enemies keep watch in case she ever returns. Elsewhere, the were-badger Azrael, driven mad by his failure, roams Sithicus, destroying any who meet him. Ganelon has managed to save Helaine from her madness, but he knows he must stay far away from her, that she is in danger as long as he is near. He travels through Sithicus, using a severed ear given to him by the Whispering Beast to help restore sanity to the insane, and using a silver knife given to him by the cobbler to perform surgery on the sick and wounded. And, far away from Sithicus, from the world of Ravenloft, in the land of Salamnia on the planet Kryn, the undead make a pilgrimage to Dargard Keep, to pay homage to the greatest among them, returned home at last, the Knight of the Black Rose. Okay, so that was Spectre of the Black Rose by James Lowder and Veronica Whitney Robinson. This novel is, at its core, the story of how Soth got back to Kryn. If you remember from the introduction to this episode, you'll recall that the Ravenloft series was drawing to a close with the end of TSR as an independent entity, and you'll also recall that the creators of Lord Soth, Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, weren't too keen on their Death Knight existing outside the world for which he'd been created. It was only a year after the publication of Spectre of the Black Rose that Weiss and Hickman would return to Dragonlance with the publication of the first of the War of Souls trilogy, Dragons of a Fallen Sun. I mentioned an addendum to the behind-the-scenes drama of Soth's character, and this is it. In the third novel of the War of Souls trilogy, Dragons of a Vanished Moon, Weiss and Hickman actually kill off Lord Soth. I won't go into detail, I'll save that for another episode, but they essentially answered the question of who controlled Soth's destiny once and for all. Lauder and Whitney Robinson constructed Spectre of the Black Rose knowing it would mean the end of Soth and Sithicus. Ravenloft was coming to a close, but Dragonlance was continuing. Weiss and Hickman were going to be featuring Soth in their new trilogy, even if it broke continuity. Lauder and Whitney Robinson wanted to wrap up Soth's story in Sithicus and return him to Dragonlance in such a way that the Dragonlance continuity and the Ravenloft continuity would remain intact, as well as plot a course for the future of Sithicus without Soth. It's a lot to accomplish in a single novel, and I'm grateful that the authors made it happen. How many TV shows have you watched week after week only to have the series canceled with major plot threads still unresolved? How many movies have you seen that tease a sequel and then nothing materializes? I'm looking at you, Super Mario Brothers. In Spectre of the Black Rose, we Soth fans are given what fans of franchises so rarely receive, a satisfactory conclusion. The downside is that there is so much going on in the novel, it can be difficult to keep it all straight. It's definitely a novel that benefits from a slower-paced read than a lot of fantasy adventure stories. There are so many characters, all with different agendas, most scheming and plotting against one another, double-crossing and triple-crossing, that sometimes the core thread of Soth's story is neglected. Soth comes off like an incompetent ruler bumbling from one mistake to the next, who then just simply slaughters his way out of every predicament. He does have a limited character arc, however. At the outset, he's lost interest in everything around him. As the story progresses, he gradually returns to active participation in the world. At the end, Isolde and the Soth kids have taken him back to Kryn so he can continue to suffer his torment, away from the memory-sapping nature of the Land of Spectres. I do appreciate that this novel carries on the same theme of memory developed initially in Knight of the Black Rose. The relationship between what a person remembers, how an event is recorded and retold, and the truth of, quote-unquote, what actually happened, is always complicated. This novel does an admirable job of maintaining that tension as Soth struggles to reclaim his own memories as false memories proliferate all around him. Part of this is Soth's own doing. He thought he could escape the horrors of his past by disappearing into the fantasy of his memory mirrors, but a story always takes on a life of its own, despite the wishes of the person who actually lived it. Yet Soth ultimately remains static. He's the same person at the end of Spectre of the Black Rose that he is at the beginning of Knight of the Black Rose. I suppose that's inevitable when writing a character who was literally cursed by the gods to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. There's not a lot of room for personal growth. The novel lacks a clear protagonist. Is it meant to be Lord Soth? He's struggling to keep his domain under his control as enemies and allies work to overthrow him, but there's nothing to suggest Soth is any less evil than Inza, Azrael, or Malocchio. He spares a few lives and he keeps his promises to Magda, but he's still a violent tyrant who murdered his own family and countless others since. Maybe a few decades in Sithicus has softened him a little bit, but he has by no means redeemed himself. Ganelon is a protagonist of sorts, since he's the only character who's truly just trying to help, but he's underdeveloped. The novel suffers somewhat from an overabundance of characters who are frankly rather uninteresting. Ganelon, Helaine, Bratu, Ambrose, Ambrose's friends, even Malocchio, Adara, and Nabon the Giant aren't that interesting. And that's forgetting the minor Vistani characters of Magda's tribe and the occasional elven citizens of Sithicus. But the novel has some wonderful characters, too. Inza seems like a bratty little girl at the beginning of the novel, and only gradually do you realize how much darkness there is inside her, and it's not until the end when you realize she was the one pulling the strings all along. She manipulates not only her mother, a powerful and intelligent woman in her own right, but even the powerful men of Sithicus and beyond, into essentially handing her the keys to the kingdom. In a way, she is successful in her ambitions. When Soth departs Sithicus, she becomes its new Dark Lord, although she is cursed to exist as a kind of living shadow. Side note, it's ironic that Soth is so furious with Inza for betraying him. In a way, she embodies all the same qualities he so admired in Kitiara. Maybe it's only because Kitiara never aimed her treachery or ruthlessness at him. My favorite characters are definitely the Bloody Cobbler and the Whispering Beast. They're just so weird. From the outside, the Bloody Cobbler appears to be a handsome, genial young half-elf, strangely dressed in a jaunty hat and a plague mask. But look closer and you can see the spots of blood on his uniformly gray clothing. He cuts off the soles of the feet of those who abandon their life's true path, like a punishment out of Dante, then sews those souls onto those lost souls who just need a helping hand, or foot, as the case may be. Is he a villain or a hero? In a story where color is so important, the gray hue of his clothing says a lot about him. Then, of course, there's the Whispering Beast. Like the Bloody Cobbler, his true motives are somewhat ambiguous. On the one hand, he drives people to madness and self-mutilation by whispering horrible things into their minds. On the other hand, these people took public oaths of their own free will and broke them of their own free will. Imagine what our society would look like if every politician who lied in public was driven insane by a hairy naked mutant with a string of ears around his neck. I think the world would be a much happier place. What I find most interesting about the Whispering Beast is that, despite his appearance and his savagery, he has a very unique personality and voice. He isn't a mindless monster. He is even kind of funny in a very disturbing sort of way. The novel also has some exciting battle scenes that are well written and feel cinematic, particularly Soth and Magda's battle against the Invidians at the bridge. It's a lot of fun seeing a character as powerful as Lord Soth unleashing all of his Death Knight powers on the invaders. Likewise, the scene when the Salt Shadows assault the Vistani camp is full of shocking moments, like the one Vistani begging his comrades to kill him rather than let him become possessed, and Magda's enormous ferocious hound becoming possessed and turning on her. My favorite scene is the flower-picking scene. Yes, you heard that right. When Ganelon takes the Whispering Beast's victims to pick red roses from Malocchio Adair's private garden, each bush is growing from a human corpse, and the vines of the bush are entwined with the bones. The bushes themselves react if anything but the bud is disturbed, and use the skeletons in which they're planted to attack. The effect is a walking skeleton tangled with thorny vines and blooming red roses, attacking as if they've been reanimated. It's a very evocative image, which I'm not doing justice here. I also have to give a shout-out to the vampire Kender, which are mentioned in the novel but never actually appear. Ganelon spots them from a distance when he's near a forest called the Fumewood, in which is hidden their village of Kenderlid. I love how Ganelon's reaction to the vampire Kender is described, because it's so hilariously incongruous with the happy, kind-hearted Kender of Kryn, and I want to read it to you. Ganelon fixed his gaze upon the more obvious danger of the Fumewood. More than once, he thought he saw shapes moving against the trees, fleet figures that carried some sort of pole weapon. Kendralid had vomited up her denizens for the night, Ganelon thought. The village lay at the heart of the Fumewood. The creatures that dwelled there were the results of some unholy experiment at Nerdregard Keep. Kender, they were called. Gaunt little monstrosities, with a penchant for thievery and a taste for human blood. Fun fact, one of the characters in my character bundle on the DM's Guild, the Dampier Halfling, was a Dampier Kender in my original conception, although unfortunately Kender are off-limits on the DM's Guild. It's really a shame that Sithicus was not included in the 5th edition Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft book. Even without Soth, Sithicus is still an interesting and spooky place with a lot of potential for adventures, especially for adventures centered around elven culture, which are quite lacking in the modern Ravenloft setting. There is one small Easter egg for fans, however. In one of the minor domains, a land called Clor, composed of the remnants of destroyed domains, travelers can sometimes encounter a blackened tower in the shape of a rose. Soth's time in Ravenloft may not be capital C canon, but his shadow lingers. All right, so I think that wraps up our episode for today. Thank you very much for listening. Before I go, don't forget to check out the Slovenly Trolls podcast and the Nothing to Fear podcast to listen to my guest appearances. And don't forget to click the link in the show notes to see what I've got on the DMs Guild. If you enjoyed this show and you want to support it, just go to patreon.com/dndbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D book club. And you can support the show for just $5 a month. And you'll also get access to exclusive bonus episodes just by becoming a patron. Thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, that's it. Just remember.